From the Christian Research Institute in Charlotte, North Carolina, this is the Bible Answer Man broadcast with Hank Hanegraaff. We're on the air because truth matters, life matters more. On today's special edition of the Bible Answer Man broadcast, we present a previously recorded episode of the Hank Unplugged podcast. Hank's guest is Noel Mehring, author of Awake, Not Woke, a Christian response to the cult of progressive ideology. And here now is Hank Hanegraaff.
And welcome to another edition of the Hank Unplugged podcast, the podcast that is committed to bringing the most interesting, informative, and inspirational people directly to your earbuds. And today will not be a disappointment. This is one of the most important podcasts I have ever done. I think this goes to the essence of civilization. I've often said that the foundation of civilization is life. And then you can build on that foundation. There are three main pillars, the pillar of church and government and marriage. But this gets to an even more granular issue, the issue of what it means to be human. And my guest today discusses this as poignantly and powerfully as anyone who has ever addressed the subject. That is my personal fervent opinion. You know, Karl Marx once said that religion is the sigh of the oppressed creature. It's the heart of a heartless world. It is the soul of soulless conditions. And then he said the abolition of religion as the illusory happiness of the people is to call on them to give up a condition that requires illusions. The criticism of religion is therefore in embryo, the criticism of that veil of tears of which religion is the halo. Again, that's Karl Marx. He's talking about what he envisioned, the fall of Western civilization, much like the fall of the Roman Empire. And let me just say as prologue to introducing my guest that we failed to stand when marriage was being redefined. We capitulated. We dare not fail with respect to the cult of wokeism. And that is the subject for today's Hank Unplugged. My guest is Noel Mehring. She holds an MA in philosophy. She is a fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center in Washington, D.C. She writes on culture, politics, religion. And she's the co-author of Theology of Home. But to the point of this podcast, she is also the author of Awake, Not Woke, A Christian Response to the Cult of Progressive Ideology. And Noel, I am really delighted to have you on the podcast. When I say I haven't seen anyone codify the essence of this subject as well as you have, I mean that with total integrity and sincerity. I think you've just done a brilliant job in this book. And I hope people will get the book. It's available for anyone who stands shoulder to shoulder with us in the battle for life and truth. But anyway, welcome.
Thank you. It's a delight and real honor to be here with you. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's an honor to have you. Can you start by just defining what we're talking about when we talk about woke or wokeism? It seems to be part of a vocabulary now, and I'm not sure that people understand what it means in precise terms.
Well, I think that maybe a lot of people would define it in sort of innocuously as the state of being alert and attuned to the various layers of oppression in society surrounding race, gender, sex, sexuality. And I think that just based on sort of that kind of simple definition, a lot of people think, well, that sounds right. You know, that sounds like something that, you know, a compassionate person should align himself with. But, you know, I think a lot of people have been realizing, particularly over the last couple of years, that there's something fundamentally off about the movement, that there's a connection between, you know, racial justice that also wants to queer the culture and disrupt the nuclear family and What unites the ideology in wanting to achieve both those goals? Why are they connected? And I think they are intrinsically connected. I think it is, you know, a real ideology, true to form, meaning that it takes partial truths and totalizes them. So it takes something that is true and starts with that, you know, and there's an injustice here. Let's look at this world purely through this filter of oppression, power, defining every human person to division as either a perpetrator or a victim, and then create moral stature based on the side of victimhood. And in that division, you kind of lean into it, raise people's consciousness about that, and then ultimately target God as the ultimate oppressor. I think he is the final target of the movement. He oppresses us, according to the movement, through the mere fact of the moral law, through any type of objective good that we should correspond our lives to, and by limiting our ability to deify ourselves by creating our own self-narrative in defiance of bodily reality, moral norms, and any sort of stabilizing force or institution. So I do think it is an ideology that's totalitarian in its essence, atheistic in its essence, as you were indicating in your earlier remarks about Marx, and also very postmodern, utterly destructive. It can only destroy, cannot construct. And I think we're seeing the rotting fruits of that all over our society now.
Yeah, so you've touched on this, but there's a linguistic characteristic to this ideology. It's a manipulation of words. We've written in the past about the word crisis that threatens to undo Western civilization. Can you expand on that a little bit, the linguistic crisis that we're facing?
Yeah, well, it, you know, really reveals the slip of the, I think, the demonic aspect throughout this, that it takes sort of, you know, the word of God, the logos, the word made flesh, that the word creates the world, that he creates the world, that we have an author. And it inverts us by deifying ourselves, that we can kind of proclaim into the world what is real based on how we self-create it, how we create it. We can speak new realities into the world. So that's a very postmodern idea, that words ultimately have power, that truth and knowledge are just functions of power. And so whoever can define the terms, whoever can define what is real, and whoever can control language is the one who has the power. And so ultimately, the woke movement is going to turn words into both something that can harm us and hurt us. If someone mispronounces me, for example, or dead names me, then that is something that fundamentally has stripped me from my dignity, has violence, according to the movement. But it's also, words are also a bludgeon. They're, you know, a hammer. They're something that we can use to destroy normativity and stabilizing forces. So I think insofar as they become so powerful, it's a sign of how weak we become, that someone can fundamentally do violence to me by not using the pronouns that I pick, for example. I mean, it just shows kind of the instability of the ideology, that if you are confident that you're proclaiming something that's true, you invite disagreement, you invite dissent. It's not a threat to you. It's not an existential threat to your position. But the movement has really inverted that because it's so built on a fundamental lie. I think that's why the control and the coercion of other people's assent to our beliefs become so crucial. And that oftentimes manifests itself by mandating the language that supports the ideology, because that in speaking something that's true in dissent of it, you really fundamentally undermine the entire construct of the ideology.
And that's why you say it has cult-like characteristics.
Yeah, it's coercive in that way, right? Cults don't tend to allow dialogue and dissent. It tends to be a very coercive, uniform sort of force, you know, for its adherence.
There's so much in your book that struck me. You talk about woke Christianity, and I have a quote here from your book. You're quoting Nadia Boltz-Weber, the author of Shameless, who says that she's calling for a Christian sexual revolution and promoting the notion that everything from transgenderism to feminism stands in accord with God's will.
Yeah. Yeah. So she was an interesting figure. I just had seen, you know, acquaintances, maybe former, I went to a Christian college and friends from college who all were kind of becoming fans of hers in particular. And she certainly is striking when you see her initially. She's a woman wearing a collar and she's got tattoos. And, you know, and then she's saying things like that, you know, that we need a new sexual revolution. She makes fun of St. Augustine. You know, certainly she thinks of the church, traditional sexual normativity as being deeply oppressive, and sees herself as her mission being only and merely to love, right? Then that love demands of us full acceptance and affirmation, particularly, I think, of the ways that we can be transgressive sexually. You know, and that's really a very strong tenet of this sort of neo-Freudian kind of element, that our freedom comes from finding the unique ways that we might be able to transgress moral codes sexually. So she kind of became a poster child in my mind for a Christianity that was moving in that direction. I think that we have been, you know, for quite a while, various churches and figures and pastors, but she really sort of fully embraced it and was owning it in a way that seemed different and new and was also compelling to more people than I would have imagined it to be. So I thought it'd be interesting to put her front and center and just say, this is, you know, this could be a potential future of the church and many churches if we don't start analyzing this and calling it out.
I want to kind of work through your book a bit. You start in part one with origins. So that begs the question, how did we get here? How did we get to this era of wokeism?
Stay right there because we'll be back soon to rejoin Hank Hanegraaff's conversation with Noel Mehring. If you're not horrified, you should be, because the relentless assaults on sanity have now reached a fevered pitch. In fact, you know nothing less than civilization is at stake when ideology trumps reality or when psychology trumps biology. That's wokeism in a nutshell. The threat is not only critical, it's urgent. Which is why Christians need to wake up and wake up fast. You won't want to miss the upcoming special issue of the Christian Research Journal that contains everything you need to know about the cult of wokeism and its impact on Western civilization. You'll read sobering articles with penetrating analysis of the social and mental disease that is reaching a flashpoint. To receive your copy of the special Woke edition of the Christian Research Journal, visit equip.org. That's equip.org. Or call 888-7000-CRI. That's 888-7000-CRI. Winston Churchill once declared, "You may have to fight when there is no hope of victory, because it is better to perish than to live as slaves." Churchill sought to awaken those who were reluctant to fight against the advancing Nazi war machine. Today, a spiritual battle is taking place. New atheism advances in the West, and slavery to secularity is imprisoning more and more hearts and minds in the United States. For this reason, CRI's ministry is critical, but we need people willing to stand for truth along with the financial provisions to accomplish its mission. Stand with Hank Hanegraaff and the Christian Research Institute during the month of June to end the fiscal year in a position of strength. Call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support CRI's life-changing outreaches. 888-7000-CRI or visit equip.org. Equip.org.
If you thought the pandemic was scary, it may actually pale in comparison to today's pandementia. We're talking about wokeism and its growing legions of followers who have defiantly and dangerously declared their independence from reality. That's right. For those infected by the woke virus, anytime their ideology encounters reality, ideology wins. To help halt the advance of this deadly social and mental disease, you'll want a copy of the upcoming special edition of the Christian Research Journal. In it, you'll feast on penetrating analyses and criticisms of one of the most dangerous ideologies in modern history, all written to help you grasp just how deranged this tyrannical movement actually is. To receive your copy, visit equip.org, that's equip.org, or call 888-7000-CRI, that's 888-7000-CRI.
The Complete Bible Answer Book, Collector's Edition, Revised and Updated, is a comprehensive collection of the most often asked as well as most difficult questions Hank Hanegraaff has received in nearly three decades of hosting the Bible Answer Man broadcast. This expanded edition contains new entries, leading readers to a better understanding of God and our relationship to Him in Jesus Christ. The Complete Bible Answer Book Collector's Edition, Revised and Updated, is a comprehensive, handy, and attractive volume that you will return to again and again. Take your exploration of God's Word to new heights and receive the Revised and Updated Complete Bible Answer Book as our thank you for your gift by calling 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support the Christian Research Institute's life-changing outreaches. 888-7000-CRI or visit equip.org. Here again are Hank Hanegraaff and his guest, Noel Mehring, as they continue their conversation.
How did we get to this era of wokeism?
Yeah, well, I go through the history. I mean, I started in this, you know, snake in the garden, cajoling the first woman that we might be as gods. And I think that is where it begins, as all sin does. But historically, you know, most people point to Karl Marx. I think it's also really interesting and important to think about and understand Hegel, who Marx was greatly influenced by. I think that's where we get a lot of the language that we don't even think twice about now, which is such as, are we on the right side of history? That's a really Hegelian statement. This idea that society develops and discovers itself all moving towards some perfect utopian endpoint, and that that endpoint we are going to be judged by now. And so it kind of creates this inability to have a limiting principle in our movement of progress, because every time you progress a little bit more, well, you're going to be old fashioned in a minute, you know, if you don't keep progressing. I think a lot of Christians thought, well, we'll just give them gay marriage. We'll redefine marriage and then we'll stop there. Well, it was never going to stop there because it doesn't limit itself. It has to move on to the next thing. And once you've dismantled any intelligible meaning of marriage, then there's no reason why you should limit that to just the same gender. It should not be limited by number anymore. That comes from Hegel. That sort of Marx was very influenced by that kind of conflict theory moving towards a utopian state. And that sort of revolution through time is going to be in some ways inevitable. He took it to a materialist level, purely. He did away with Hegel's sort of attachment to rationalism and the absolute spirit. But when the revolution did not come about, there were a group of Marxists that were left frustrated. They thought it was inevitable. The proletariat, the working class, just had to realize how miserable that they were, and then they would revolt, and we'd be moving closer to a communist state. So when it didn't happen, they formed an Institute for Social Research and matriculated to the United States around 1935, welcomed by John Dewey at Columbia University, came to be known as Frankfurt School, and they were really brought with them a convergence of neo-Marxism, also neo-Freudianism. And so there you see the seeds of the woke movement. My liberation is by triumphing over oppressive groups outside of myself, but my liberation is also by triumphing over my own internalized instinct to repress my more transgressive desires. So through that convergence, they just realized what we have to do is seed the institutions of culture. This is also Antonio Gramsci's idea, that we have to, as we can, it's going to be a long march to the institutions. As we place the seeds of revolution into the powerful institutions, law, academy, Hollywood, popular culture, art, education, make all of these, turn activists into in through all these institutions. That is how we will seed revolution in the West. The West was really resistant to revolution because we had strong understanding of family ties. We have a strong Christian background history and animating us even still, and that we believed and respected in the authority of fatherhood, you know, that we understood that to be a beautiful thing. And so you can see how, if you even think about even in just isolating popular culture, I think we all joke about how TV shows have all become, you know, mockeries of fatherhood. You know, the father's the bumbling idiot or the oppressive preacher who with a wife who's a doormat. But those narratives actually really do affect us, I think, deeply. And Frankfurt School guys knew that. They would say, you know, exaggerate reality. Your job in creating art is not to reflect what is real so much as it is to exaggerate what the oppressive narratives in order to raise people's consciousness. And I think that's been really effective. We are very affected by stories. You know, we're people who, you know, look and watch, you know, we might watch enough compelling movies that give us one narrative and start to look at our lives as though this is around every corner. This is what we see in our neighbors, what we see in ourselves. We become suspicious. Once that archetype of the, you know, fatherhood, for example, is kind of dismantled in our minds. So I think it was far more effective than we understand. I mean, even if you think about the feminist movement, so Marcuse really understood that the feminist, burgeoning feminist movement in the 60s was something that could be exploited to turn something that is maybe oriented around, you know, kind of arguing for, you know, the, well, historically the suffragettes or some things that, you know, are arguably fine and good and just. But we can lean into this division and create a deeper division, a deeper divide, and train them to realize that there is no ability to right this institution, that it has to actually be destroyed. This marriage has to be destroyed. Smash the patriarchy. You know, that there's some institutional ways in which men have run society that is utterly poisonous, are utterly poisonous. So it became this force for utter destruction in multiple ways, not just through art and popular culture, but obviously I think we're seeing it largely through the academy and through media as well, and law, and now medicine. So I think it's been effective and we're seeing that now, but it was, you know, also the postmodern movement is important. I go into that a little bit, as we talked about earlier, that it was really added, sort of put on steroids, everything that's already happening and ruining kind of any possibility of having common narratives, common historical shared understandings of the goodness of, you know, our country, our having a patriotism that is something that's admirable and not something that is naive or ignorant. And insofar as those narratives have become destroyed, I think we've lost a lot of ability to have a brotherhood of man, to have, you know, common citizenship, to have family history, to have heroes, you know, all of these icons that I think really unify us have been taken from us. And that was largely the leading into the woke movement.
You talk about marching through the academy, and your book does such a good job of explaining how we're training teachers and people on all levels of the societal ladder in critical theory. So people hear about critical theory, either CT or critical race theory, CRT, and oftentimes can't identify precisely what we're talking about there. And I think this is the heart of the issue. And this is now overwhelming, certainly the educational environment, the environmental system, the entertainment system, etc. This has really taken hold, and there's a narrative around it that seems to stick.
Yeah, a writer once said that critical theory is basically criticizing something until you destroy it. And I think that that's as simple as any other. I think oftentimes we confuse critical theory with critical thinking. And so people who are trained to do critical thinking will think that they're having a conversation based on critical thinking. They don't realize that, you know, I'm trying to dialogue, you're trying to dominate, right? So as I indicated earlier, or touched upon a bit, the critical thinker, the end of dialogue is truth. You want to arrive at the truth. And so if you are off in some way, or if you don't have the full picture, you want someone to point that out. You invite criticism, you invite objections, because if you want to arrive at the truth, then that's only helpful to your purpose. For the critical theorists, the goal is not truth. The goal is power, domination. And so you don't invite objection. Rather, you want to silence objection. And this is rife throughout the literature. So Marcuse wrote a pivotal essay called Repressive Tolerance. And this is echoed by Robin DiAngelo and Ibram X. Kendi and contemporary woke figures, that the goal is not to hear equal sides. We don't want to hear, give you a voice and then give this other side a voice. We actually want to silence the dominant voices that have plagued society. And so I think we oftentimes will say, you know, you'll have people who are of the older school saying, well, this is such hypocrisy. I'm not giving, you know, they're not hearing, they're not dialoguing, they're not hearing both sides. But that's not the point. I think the point isn't hypocritical. It's, as someone else said, it's hierarchical, that this is a new structure of dominance where some people will be platformed and some people will be deplatformed. And that's the way the ideology works. And critical race theory is just that sort of neo-Marxism applied to race. Critical gender theory is it applied to gender. But it's the same animal. It's about raising people's consciousness to oppression and ultimately destruction.
You talk in the book about dogmas. It's part two of your very insightful book. What are the primary dogmas of wokeism?
Well, the three things I distilled it down to are three sort of distortions. The first one being an emphasis on group over person. So that's the collectivist mindset that I'm only valuable or I'm not valuable as an individual. I'm valuable insofar as I might further an ideology. I'm a totem of a group, right? So we see this with the way in which, for example, a conservative Black man won't have a voice, right? He won't be uplifted because it's not about supporting him as a racial minority. It's about supporting someone who will support the ideology. It's political far more than personal. This creates a society where you have that instinct to proclaim a victim status in order to say that you have moral stature. That's what gives you a voice. And I think we see this all over the place. I mean, you know, we can even have instincts in ourselves that, you know, it's so ubiquitous now that sometimes, you know, we might find ourselves thinking, well, how have I been hurt and how might that give me a platform to speak from which to speak? It's become ingrained in us, I think, in large part. So that group over person is the first one. But the second one I call will over reason. It's will over reason or will over nature, which are connected. So the idea that we have a stable human nature, meaning that our nature has a purpose. We have a purpose to our bodies. There's a purpose to our fertility. There's a purpose to sexuality. There's an intelligibility to how we were created. And that speaks to something about where our flourishing might lie. And that intelligibility, so that's bringing the reason in. And the movement will say that we know we don't prioritize reason in the old sort of like ancient Greek understanding that, you know, there was I think it's Platonic, that there's a chariot. Our reason is directing the chariot, you know, and then there's our spirit and there's our will. But you want to get your will in line with your reason. So you want to identify, okay, this is might be what I want. This might be pleasurable, but I ought to do this. And so how can I will the thing that I ought to will? And then through that process of that habit of virtue, you begin to have an affection for the good, right? You begin to not only like kind of grit your teeth and choose the thing you ought to choose, but you begin to actually desire the good. You know, this is how we become self-governing, self-ruling individuals.
We'll have to stop here for today's special edition of the Bible Answer Man broadcast. Join us again next time when we will continue Hank Hanegraaff's conversation with Noel Mehring. You thought only religions have dogmas? Think again. Because wokeism has its dogmas, and these dogmas demand obedience, not merely consent. Obey or be canceled. No dissent allowed. The problem is that woke dogmas are a path straight to civilization hell. Because the dogmas of this social disease are so deadly, we've tackled them head on in an upcoming special edition of the Christian Research Journal. The fact that even historically sane institutions are daily falling victim to this pandementia demonstrates how deceptively dangerous this mental cancer actually is. To receive your copy of the special woke edition of the Christian Research Journal, visit equip.org. That's equip.org. Or call 888-7000-CRI. That's 888-7000-CRI. You can also write CRI at Post Office Box 8500, Charlotte, North Carolina, zip code 28271. The Bible Answer Man broadcast is funded by listeners like you. We're on the air because truth matters, life matters more. The Soviet Red Army won the Battle of Stalingrad. It appeared at first the Nazi war machine would secure the victory, but the Soviets battled back from near certain defeat with extraordinary courage and resoluteness to turn the tide of the battle and ultimately the war. The lesson is that both men and material, people and provisions played a critical role. Willingness to fight and munitions in the arsenal were pivotal. Our contemporary battle for truth against anti-Christian secularists raises the stakes above the significance of Stalingrad. CRI likewise needs military partners willing to stand for truth, along with the financial means to accomplish the mission. Stand with us during the key month of June to end the fiscal year in a position of strength. Call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support CRI's life-changing outreaches, or visit equip.org.